Well, I wonder who that sad little scrap of paper is.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey.
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Mike Malott. A little later, we're going to have Matt Morgan. He is the congressional candidate in the 1st District for the Democrats. He's the only one in the field right now. Could be others down the line, but as of right now, he is the only one in the race. A little later, we're also going to be talking about Abdul Al-Sayyad is not going to be marching in the Labor Day parade. How big of a deal is that going to be for his prospects down the line, if it is at all? But first, Mike, I want to talk about the big discussion we're going to have in this Capitol in the Lansing when the lawmakers come back, and that is whether the Senate Republicans are going to decide to put on the board a veto override of a speed-up of the sales tax on the difference, which is the sales tax expiration schedule that we set up for trade-ins, vehicle trade-ins of all things. We're willing to go ahead and override the veto on this. And Mike, looking back at history, and according to the Associated Press over the weekend, there have been three times in the last 70 years we've seen the legislature override a governor's veto. And I thought the most interesting one was in 1951 when Soapy Williams vetoed a Republican bill to raise the gas tax. It was the Republican legislature that wanted the gas tax, and Soapy Williams said, I'm only going to raise the gas tax if you incorporate some kind of corporate income tax, to which the Republicans said, our roads are too bad, we're not going to fuss with a corporate tax, we're just going to go ahead and raise the gas tax, and they were able to do it.
I feel like those were simpler times. You might not see a similar pressure from the Republicans for a gas tax increase today. But keep in mind who's the constituents of whom. The gas tax would have applied to the general populace, and Republicans would have been a little bit more concerned about putting an income tax on corporations. So it begins to make some sense. But you might not see a similar vote today.
I think that's a fair assumption, right? The other one in 1977 had to do with Governor Milliken and the legislature having discussions about JCAR, the Joint Committee on Administrative Rules. That's not necessarily a big surprise because I think as long as we've had this type of three branches of government with the executive and the legislature and the judicial branch, the legislature and the governor's office, whoever it is, and no matter what the parties are going to have a power struggle about JCAR and the oversight role of the legislative branch on the executives.
Well, and right now I'm hearing more complaints out of lawmakers about administrative rules that the governor's office has enacted. So there may be, and they're a little frustrated by the fact that the administration passes rules that don't go through the legislature, although they do have JCAR to override that if they choose to exercise that authority. But you may see that issue come back if they get a little more frustrated. If there's more administrative rules, they may make a bigger issue out of it.
But I think where this ties in, and I think there is a tie in here, is that it's not necessarily the issue. I mean, whether we phase out the sales tax on the difference, the sales tax on trade-in, vehicle trade-ins, in 30 years or in 20 years, I don't know if it makes a heck of a lot of difference in the grand scheme of state politics. However, it sends a message, doesn't it, from the legislature to the governor's office of, hey, you're not just going to veto every old thing we send you. If we feel strongly about something on a bipartisan basis, we can do this. And that kind of disembowels the governor a little bit.
Well, yeah, there's a natural power struggle between the two, and that's the way the system's set up. There's supposed to be a power struggle, a balance of power. But there's supposed to be some give and take between the two. I think where the governor is most concerned about this, though, is the financial aspects of it. They had a plan worked out for the current schedule of the phase in, and you accelerate that, and the costs go up substantially in a very quick order. The legislature, although they sped it up, has not said how they're paying for it.
Well, and that's the whole point of the phase in the first place. I mean, 30 years for the sales tax on the difference. If you speed it up 10 years, allegedly, according to the House Fiscal Agency, that's $300 million over 30 years. If you look at Department of Treasury numbers, it's 187 some over 20 years. You know, in the budget, which is $55 billion, it's a small amount, but I think it's kind of the governor taking a look at the fact, hey, this road tax thing that we did, look at that, we're tying this back into the road tax in 1951, right? Because of the road tax, they're going to be looking at, or a future governor is going to be looking at, structural deficit of the budget of up to $2 billion, according to the Citizen Research Council.
They're not small chunks of change. They may be small to the proportion of the budget, but trying to make up that kind of money is, they got to figure out where that's from. And the legislature hasn't not yet done that. They passed this, but they haven't said where the money's coming from.
I thought it was really interesting, the research that you did last week and the week before, maybe either 2 weeks before that. Was that how long you've been doing this?
It's been at least 2 weeks, but I kind of lost track because I was over at the library looking through back journals and then doing some other things in the middle of it.
So I've always wanted to do this, and I'm so glad you were able to put numbers to this. The king or the queen of vetoes in the state of Michigan. Tell our listeners exactly what you were doing.
Well, what we looked at was, because the issue is about how often Snyder vetoes items, we looked at who's exercised the veto pen the most often. And what we found is that Snyder, in his 6.5 years, has vetoed 63 bills. And that works out to 9.69 vetoes per year on average. But that's actually pretty light when it comes to vetoes. John Engler, former Governor John Engler, vetoed 264 bills, and that works out to an average of 22 per year in his time. Jennifer Granholm vetoed 212 bills, but she was only in office 8 years, so she had an overall average that was even higher, which was 26.5 vetoes per year. It was interesting when you look at when she had a all-Republican legislature to deal with, she was vetoing bills at the rate of 41 vetoes a year.
Wow.
Which is kind of astounding to me. But then when the legislature was divided and she had Democrats in control of the House, that average dropped down to about 11 vetoes per year. So it's significant. But most other governors had a heavier hand on vetoes. Jim Blanchard did, Bill Milliken, George Romney, and John Swainson. You got to go back a half century to G-Men and Williams to find somebody who vetoed bills at a lower rate than Rick Snyder.
Well, I think there's a couple things here, too. The technical aspect of how we do the budget under Rick Snyder is a lot different than how we did it under Granholm and Engler. We're doing this omnibus now, where the entire budget is basically wound up into two budget bills, the omnibus and the school bus. And it's a lot different than when we had, 15 or 16 different departmental budgets going in front of the governor. And so if she didn't like something in the DCH budget and the Department of Corrections budget and the Department of Natural Resources budget, well, that's three vetoes. Whereas for Snyder, if he doesn't like something in those three budgets, it's only one veto. Now, that's a little technical and probably lowers the average a little bit.
But significant. But right. That number would make it different. In the vetoes that I was looking at, there might be 13 line items in an individual veto. Now, I didn't go through and separate all those. I just counted that as one bill. But sure, a lot of line items came out. That is a significant change in the way it gets counted.
But also, we got to think about the personality of Rick Snyder. I mean, Rick Snyder is not a confrontational type of person. He doesn't keep score like John Engler kept score. You voted no on my bill, even though I needed your support. Oh, your bill's in front of me right now. Guess what? Boom. Veto. All right. So those are the types of things that John Engler would do. That is not Rick Snyder's style. So it doesn't necessarily surprise me that his number's a little low when it compares to others, given that scenario.
That's all true, but keep in mind also that the politics of the time is a little bit different. Rick Snyder came to office with a business agenda, a financial, fix the finances in the state agenda. John Engler came to and came to Lansing with a social agenda at the height of the culture wars. Granholm was in that same time period, so there were whole different issues that were coming forward that Snyder isn't really on his agenda.
That's a good point, because what you saw when Snyder came into office was more about Republicans getting together and doing a pro-business agenda,
right,
one that his cohorts in the legislature weren't exactly going to say no to. In fact, the legislature is probably going further than what Snyder wanted, for instance, putting a cap on the type of rules that the state could put in there, and saying that you can't have rules that are more strict than the federal government. Even that was a little too far for the pro-business governor, Rick Snyder.
Right, so, right.
Last thing I want to touch on before we go to the interview, Abdul El-Sayed has decided that he is not going to be marching in the Labor Day parade, which is usually a gimme for anyone who's running statewide for some type of Democratic political office. Now, we are still a year away from the primary, less than a year away, I guess, now from the primary. How significant do you think that is, that Abdul El-Sayed is not marching or doesn't feel like he has to march?
Given that Abdul comes out of the progressive wing of the party, I'm not sure if this indicates a schism in the Democratic Party in the same way that we see factions fighting over control of the Republican Party, but it might be an indicator. Abdul sees himself as a progressive. Progressives don't necessarily cater to the union vote, but that's a significant base within the party. And I think, as we saw in the Bernie Sanders candidacy, that you know there are factions struggling to control the direction of the Democratic Party in the future.
I thought it was interesting as well, because you look at what Bernie Sanders did, and it was not on the backs of union, but you would think that he would need organized labor at some point. If he were to win this nomination, and maybe he doesn't get endorsements before the nomination, but let's say he wins this nomination, he's going to need organized labor. He's going to need their support to go out and mobilize people and vote in elections. So it would seem like it would make a lot more sense for him to march in there, and maybe he changes his schedule and maybe he doesn't. But to take a personal day on Labor Day, I can understand, but it would seem like marching in the parade and then maybe going home and spending time with the family or whatever would make more sense. But I'm not him. I don't understand the dynamics or whatever. I'm just saying that for optics' sake, it would look better if he were there than if he were not.
Oh, I would think so. And why not at least have a relationship with the unions? You do need their support if you're going to run as a Democrat in this state particularly.
And it's just not, and I would emphasize that, in this state, it's not like a national election where organized labor plays a pretty big role, but not massive. In this state, it is a lot more massive. I mean, if the UAW and all the other players get behind you, that signals you'll probably win the nomination.
Union influence is diminished somewhat, but they're still big players in this state. And as a Democrat, you ignore them at your peril.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's move on to the interview portion of the podcast. Matt Morgan, he is a candidate from the 1st Congressional District and a Democrat. Thanks for joining us on the show today, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. Where do you come from, and what brought you to Northern Michigan?
Well, I joined the Marine Corps when I was 17 years old and spent really my entire adult life in uniform. So over the course of my my career, I lived in about 6 different states in the U.S. and served in over 22 different countries around the world. But when I was in the Marine Corps, I met another Marine officer who grew up in Kalkaska, Michigan. And after we were married, we knew that we wanted to bring our boys back here and raise them. So after I retired from the Marine Corps as Lieutenant Colonel in 2013, my wife Angie and I brought our boys back here to Traverse City, kind of just start over.
Were you born into a military family? Was your folks in the military?
You know, my father served in the Army in Vietnam, but I wouldn't necessarily characterize our family as a military family. He served, many of his uncles served in Korea and World War II, but, you know, service was something that was definitely important in terms of the way I was raised, whether it was community service or service through your church, or individual, you know, military service was always something that was part of my upbringing. And so when I had the opportunity, the Marine Corps is something that really spoke to me in terms of a career.
So where are you from originally then? Where did you grow up and go to high school?
I grew up in East Central Illinois. It was in a rural farming community. We grew up about 5 miles outside of the nearest town of about 2,500 people. It was a railroad town, rural farming community and railroad. Most of the kids that I went to school with, in fact, their parents either were farmers, railroaders, or they worked in the coal mines. So very similar Midwestern kind of background.
So when you were turned 17, graduated from high school, the military was calling for you, or you had a calling for the military, rather, and you joined the Marines at that point.
Yeah, you know, the Marine Corps is something that had been on my radar since, I'm old enough to remember the Iran hostage crisis and the Beirut barracks bombing in 1983. So I was introduced kind of at a young age to the concept of the Marine Corps and selfless service. It was always something that I aspired to, and so I was given the opportunity to accept the Naval ROTC scholarship and become a Marine officer. It's something I jumped at.
And so then, how many years did you end up serving in the Marines?
I spent just over 20 years on active duty. I retired in 2013.
Where did you end up going? Were you ever in Iraqi Freedom or Afghanistan?
Yeah. I'm a post 9/11 combat veteran. I served in Iraq, a total of about 18 months of service in Iraq between two combat deployments there, and service as well in the Horn of Africa in late 2003, supporting counterterrorism operations there.
Now, my understanding is that you got married in Kalkaska, is that right?
That's right. My wife grew up there in Kalkaska. Her parents were both educators. Her dad was a principal in Kalkaska at the high school there for many years. So that's where Angie and I were married, and then we had our reception here in Traverse City. So that was enough for us to make the decision that we were going to come back here.
So what is it about Kalkaska and Democrats wanting to run for Congress? We had Lon Johnson, Jerry Cannon, and now we got you. What's going on there with the local Democratic Party there? Has it got the monopoly on the Democrats over there?
You know, I don't know what it is. I think that in part it has to do with the fact that Kalkaska is a community that is in many ways representative of all the good and the bad that we see here in the state of Michigan in terms of communities that are challenged economically, but still possess some very straightforward Midwestern values. You know, I don't know Lon very well, but I do know Jerry Cannon. In fact, the Cannons were family friends of my wife's family for many years. I know Jerry very well, respect him a great deal, supported his candidacy as well. And we firmly believe that a candidate from this type of area can do well as a Democrat in this district.
Did he give you some advice before you decided to run, or did he recruit you? How did that dynamic play out?
No, as a matter of fact, when I called Jerry and told him that I was considering running, he was extremely supportive, although, you know, somewhat surprised because I had been, you know, seeing firsthand a lot of the challenges that he had experienced in his race, both in the 2014 race and in the primary 2016. But he's given me a great deal of advice, continues to mentor me and be able to help out in terms of, advice on managing the campaign.
You guys have a mayor there in Kalkaska who's kind of controversial. What do you make of him? Do you think he should resign, or what's been kind of your attitude about his actions and what he's been posting on Facebook or reposting on Facebook?
Well, first and foremost, I will say that having, you know, a great deal of experience serving in Muslim majority nations and serving alongside Muslim allies, I will be the first to tell you that taking a position against an entire set of individuals based primarily upon their religion is completely unacceptable and frankly un-American. One of the things that I did within the Pentagon in 2008 and 2009 was to work on efforts to counter violent extremist recruiting. And I will tell you that when we marginalize all Muslims because of a small minority of them who take actions as violent extremists, what we do is we help the adversary to recruit more to their cause. So to take a position that attacks all Muslims for their faith is frankly ignorant and completely unacceptable in my view as Americans. I believe that the vast majority of the citizens there in Kalkaska have taken a strong position. I support what they're trying to do in terms of their effort to recall the president. He has to understand that as a public official, he is going to be accountable for all his comments, public and private. It does not matter. And he needs to take responsibility for that. And frankly, if he wants to keep his position there in the community, he just needs to come out and apologize. But I also want to make the point that what he's been doing there in that community has not been successful for the community of Kalkaska in terms of drawing in better economic investments. The community not only needs to be holding him accountable for his racist remarks, but for his failure of ability to lead and produce viable economic results for the community.
So I'm not up to date on exactly what's happening with Jeff Seeding, but is there an effort to recall him right now? And if so, where is that at in the process?
I don't know precisely. I need to make clear that I'm not a resident of Kalkaska. My wife grew up there, but we actually live in Traverse City. My in-laws do still live there in Kalkaska, so I'm following it through, you know, through their eyes and through what many activists in the area are doing to oppose Seeding. But I'm not up to date exactly on where things are in terms of the recall effort.
Going back to when you came to Kalkaska in 2013, what kind of job did you do after you guys came back?
The primary thing that I was doing was working as a technical consultant in television and motion pictures. As a retired Marine, it was something that I could do essentially on a part-time basis.
Oh, that's really cool. What does that mean? You mean you consult them on what like a battle would look like or how the military would operate or something like that?
Yes. The first project that I worked on right after I retired was American Sniper. I have a good friend who's been in the business for a long time, several films, including Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima. And as soon as I retired, he called me and said, listen, we're putting this project together with Clint. I need an Iraq veteran who can work with me on the film. So the principal responsibility that I had on that film was to train the extras who were portraying Marines to look, act, and perform like Marines. In Fallujah in 2004-2005.
Wow, that would be really fun. So did they fly you out to wherever the shooting was and the shooting of the
right.
film? And
yeah, we shot that primarily in Morocco, the capital city there. We did that for the exteriors in Iraq, and then we did the rest of the shooting primarily in Southern California.
Oh, wow. Well, that sounds really exciting. So that sounds more fun than running for Congress. What made you want to run for Congress?
Working in film is entertaining, but it is by no means as rewarding as career service. So while I was enjoying what I was doing, when I was presented with the opportunity to step back into public service, I knew that it was exactly the type of thing that I needed to be with.
And how did that opportunity present itself? Did somebody approach you and say, hey, you would be a real good member of Congress, or you should really think about running for public office?
You know, after the elections last fall, both my wife and I spent a great deal of time soul searching, like a lot of people did, I think, asking ourselves whether we've done enough in terms of the election. We all, you know, at least my wife and I, we concluded that we hadn't done enough. And in January, I listened to President Obama's remarks, his farewell address, and part of that address toward the end, he made a statement that said, I'm asking you not to believe in the change that I can bring, but in the change that you can bring. And that kind of struck me, and I set the wheels turning, and several weeks later, I was with a group of individuals who asked me if I had considered running. And the truth is, I hadn't. I mean, I'd spent my entire career in military service. Public office was not something I had, frankly, ever considered. So after it was presented to me, my wife and I spent the next 1 to 2 days really seriously thinking about it, talking to our kids about it, and I really made the decision that this was the opportunity. And if I couldn't say yes to this, how could I ask anybody else?
How old are your boys?
I have a 12-year-old and a 6-year-old.
What did they think about the idea of you going across the first congressional district campaigning for this?
My 6-year-old loves the idea because my wife promised him that if I win, we can get a dog.
It's the little things, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And the older one, it took a little bit for him to come around to the idea. You know, I had to sit down and have a one-on-one with him and tell him that there would be people that might say things about me. You know, he he experienced, you know, this election, this last presidential election in middle school. Middle school can be a tough place, and a lot of kids bring their parents' attitudes and opinions to school with them. And so I think a lot of the negativity that characterized the presidential campaign in 2016 carried its way right on into middle school. So, you know, he heard a lot of things said there. And so the idea that, you know, people might say things, nasty things about his dad, you know, whether true or not, was a difficult hurdle for him to get past. But once he decided that, you know, he could, then that was what it took for him.
Now, as a political observer, look at the first congressional district, and I see a district that's trending more Republican, although it's been represented by a Democrat not too long ago. The numbers seem to be going in the opposite direction for Democrats. Why is that not a discouraging factor for you? Or maybe it is.
I think when we really look at the numbers and the way that they trend between elections, not just general elections, but at the midterm, we believe that the district is absolutely winnable. I've had the opportunity to talk with Congressman Stupak about how he ran and how he worked the district while he was in office. Just recently completed his book, and I really believe, you know, and agree with what he told me, which is in this district, if you shake somebody's hand, ask them what is important to them, and then ask them for their vote, that you've got a better 50-50 chance of getting it, regardless of what party you're from. I think that it really takes an effort to connect with voters. You have to be authentic, and you have to have a certain kind of background. The candidate, him or herself, has to have a certain kind of makeup and a background, and I believe that we have the type of candidacy that can connect with voters. And there's enough voters out there that are willing to set aside or disregard a specific party, so long as you're willing to listen to them.
Now, you've been in this race since April, basically, right? Or March?
That's right. We announced, I believe, April 19th.
What have you done since then to set up for this run?
Well, one, I put 12,000 miles in my truck so far. This is a 25,000 square mile district, 31 and a half counties. There's a lot of places to be. And so that, to me, is the key, to get out to key areas, to know where the votes are, to be able to listen, to understand the issues. And that's key for me. And then, of course, is the necessity of fundraising. I'm a political outsider. I'm not somebody who, prior to this race, had ever picked up the phone and asked someone for money. It took a little bit of time for me to break into that. Not something I think that any candidate is ever going to be comfortable with, or should they ever be comfortable with, but I also think that any candidate out there will tell you there's a certain amount of muscle memory to doing it. As you start working in call time more and more to connect with those potential donors, to help describe for them your candidacy as a viable candidacy, the more time you can spend doing that, the better you are. So that's one of the reasons why we believe to announce in Q2 and begin fundraising there in the second quarter that early, because, you know, particularly for progressive candidates who has to get a majority of the first year, the first three quarters contributions from individual donors, you have to look that aspect of it very hard. So that's really one of the big things, of course, we've been doing in addition to traveling the second quarter.
And then the other thing I wanted to ask you about, obviously the incumbent there in the first district is retired Marines as well, Lieutenant General. When you go talk to folks, how do you differentiate and say you are a better Marine or a better option than the Marine who's in office right now?
I don't try to compare my experience with Congressman Bergman, because really you can't directly compare any individual veteran's experience. While many outside of the military might look at the military experience as you know, singularly characteristic of a specific experience, in fact, every veteran, their world is different. What I do is offer a few points of contrast, and one is that Congressman Bergman and I are from different generations. He's a Cold Warrior. I'm a post-9/11 combat veteran. We see the world very differently. I will point directly to one of his campaign ads where he used this tired expression, the same thing that President Trump did, which is to call out, quote, violent Islamic extremism. that right there is a key indicator that Congressman Bergman has absolutely no understanding of the core issue as it relates to violent extremism in the world today. The second thing I would say is that being a post 9/11 combat veteran, I see the world very differently than he does. And I would make the distinguishing characteristic in that my military experience was active duty. In other words, I put on the uniform and never took it off. Congressman Bergman's experience was iterative in that he was, for most of his career, was an airlines pilot who kind of did the Marine Corps thing as a reservist. And so our worldviews from that perspective are different in that as well.
You mentioned his view on violent extremism, not him not having a good understanding on that, and that's a core difference. Tell me from your opinion, what is causing the violence?
When I worked at the Pentagon, I came back from Iraq, my second tour in 2008, and went to work for Secretary Gates. And I was part of the team that was undertaking an effort to develop policy in regards to countering violent extremist recruiting within vulnerable populations. So what we had to really do is dig in and understand exactly how it is violent extremists are able to radicalize and mobilize young men to violence around the world. And one of the things that we saw very quickly as we began digging into this was that the notion of religion is something that was being perverted. And to draw lines in the sand, as had been done early on, to say you're either with us or against us, is not an effective way to work to counter their recruiting. Essentially, if you pin it on Islam and force them to pick sides, regrettably, you are pushing them in the wrong direction. The types of things that motivate these young men are basic concepts like power over others, iconography, being part of something greater than oneself, be coming from areas that make them vulnerable, whether it's food insecurity, job insecurity, the future. One of the things that drives young men, particularly in the Middle East, North and Eastern Africa, into these groups is that they have absolutely no social or economic way forward. And so for them, the notion of joining an organization that empowers them and gives them status is very attractive. Islam is only a secondary mechanism that allows those framers to hang it on something that is moral. It is no different than if we were today to call, for example, the radicals in Charlottesville, the violent white supremacist nationalists and white nationalists that showed up in Charlottesville, it would be the same as tagging them as violent Christian extremists, because their ideology is rooted in the perverted form of Christianity. And so to call that out would essentially be underpinning their argument itself, which is why focusing on the Islamic aspects of extremism is just frankly ignorant and does not focus on what really the core issues are with regard to what violent extremists use in terms of recruiting.
That's very interesting. So essentially then, it's not necessarily the religion, it's how religion is framed and used to try and recruit these people toward a particular cause or a particular movement, if you will. Yeah, that's also religion, fueled by probably their economic situation as well.
Religion is just a tool. When I served in Iraq in 2008, I worked in detainee operations as a policy advisor there, and my boss had a very clear way of framing it. Most of the people that we had in detention were not people who had frankly been radicalized. They were individuals that had been approached by someone who said, ask them simple questions. Do you like the Americans being here? The Iraqis would say, no, we don't like the Americans here. They would ask them, do you need some extra money? And they would say, I can always use a little extra money. And then the last question would be, are you a good Muslim? To which they would always answer yes. And so the hook for the recruiter was, what if I told you you could get rid of these Americans, make a little scratch, and get right with God? What would you say? So that was their basic pitch. And understanding that was crucial to understanding how to de-link the radicals' ability to effectively recruit and mobilize these individuals. I mean, a lot of the guys we had in detention in Iraq were there because they'd been caught digging a hole in a road somewhere at night. And the guys that were in detention, those were the lucky ones, because the way rules of engagement were written in Iraq, it would have been just as easy to kill them.
Wow, and digging a hole meant they were going to put a roadside bomb or something in, right? Yeah. Okay. Wow, that's interesting. Well, listen, I've taken up more than enough of your time, and I appreciate the time here. Matt Morgan, a Democratic candidate in the 1st Congressional District, thank you so much for being on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thanks, I appreciate the time.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Matt Morgan for joining us for the podcast. Mike Malott, as always, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.
He signed your bill. Now you're a law.
Oh, yeah.